The Guardian.
Football Weekly is sponsored by Squarespace. Make your next move and create your next website using Squarespace's all-in-one platform. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code Football Weekly to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain.
Today, Champions League, with the Foxes, the Sevilla team they outfoxed, the foxy Monaco, and City, who fox it up again. It was another effing interesting midweek. We marvel again at manager Shakespeare's success, wonder if it's actually done by an assistant called Marlowe, and commiserate with City after what we could call the worst performance on the road in Monaco since Princess Grace, if we weren't too sensitive for all that kind of thing. Next up, though, it's Liverpool. Can Pep's side recover from what must have been a painful evening on Wednesday, repeatedly pierced and run rings around before a Prince Albert? And how will Leicester fare on their return to the relegation race? We'll preview all the weekend's action up and down the continent, savour your posts and comments, and hear an eyewitness account of what happened when AFC Wimbledon took on another team this midweek. All of that in this Football Weekly Extra. Hurrah! Simon Burnton, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today, Simon.
Yep.
Got James Horncastle up in this.
All up in this grill.
Yep. And also Jacob Steinberg, an untimely swig of tea for you, Jacob.
That's not tea. That is water.
Bingo.
Yep.
All right. Hydrated and ready to rock with another Football Weekly Extra. A Football Weekly Extra, which in untraditional fashion begins with some breaking news as opposed to being swiftly followed by some breaking news. This time they fired the manager just before we went on air. It is, to nobody's great surprise, Aitor Karanka gone at Middlesbrough, and with Steve McClaren so recently liberated from his managerial duties. Can this be any coincidence, Simon?
Well, that could probably be a coincidence, though you never know. You know, it's a bit of a shock, but at the same time, it is quite good timing. If they think that they need someone to turn their season around, this is the moment. They have 2 weeks of international break after they play Manchester United this weekend, and they come back to the three crunch games of their season. Swansea away, Hull away, Burnley home. And, you know, that's going to define where they end up, those three games. And if Karanka's not the man, then someone else, if they find an appointment, if they have an appointment ready and they can get him in soon, has the opportunity, has a good space of time to coach the team and get them ready to play the way he wants for the, in those three matches. And in the meantime, there's been all this talk of training ground bust-ups with Stuart Downing, problems with Patrick Bamford. There were, I mean, presumably, well, so last March is when he had his last meltdown,
right,
and had another training ground bust up and stormed out and missed a game at Charlton. He seems to have a thing about Marches and couldn't survive this one.
Right.
The Ides of March.
Right.
Do you think he'll be actually coming back a game later like he did last time?
Good question. One which we'll be addressing later on in the show, because Champions League. And it was another extraordinary midweek of action. Who fed football after midnight? That's my question. It's all gone crazy. Tuesday, we had that extraordinary match at the King Power, which you MBM'd, I think, Jacob.
Yep.
Did you enjoy it?
It was a very enjoyable game.
Yeah.
Amazing, because no one would have given Leicester much of a chance before the start of the tie, and especially when they were 2-0 down in Sevilla and looking like they were going to get an almighty pasting off a very, very good side. And they had already seen a penalty saved Sevilla in that first game, and I think if they'd gone into it 2-0 up, then it may well have been a different story. But right. Jamie Vardy's goal just completely changed the mood. And obviously, since then, you had the Claudio Ranieri sacking, which was greeted with the usual, predictable, typical, moral, self-righteous outrage, which wasn't remotely justified because they had to do something to act to make sure they didn't go down. And Craig Shakespeare has come in, and he has the same name as William Shakespeare, which is interesting. And he's also turning out to be doing quite a good job as well. The players really
covering
like him.
All the bases here.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're in the minute-by-minute, someone pointed out that he has also the same first name as several famous Craigs as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How many?
Daniel Craig, Craig David.
He hasn't got the same first name as Daniel Craig.
Craig Burley.
Craig Burley, I'll give you.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Which was very interesting as well.
Sevilla and Jorge Sampaoli, who's, you know, mentioned in relation to perhaps the Barcelona job and very highly thought of, his exploits, the 20 12 World Cup,
and
all that
Copa
kind of
Americas
thing.
Copa Americas as well.
And the Copa America, of course. Yeah.
But they're third in La Liga.
Yeah, right? No, they're doing well. I was just surprised at their approach against this Leicester. I know they faced them and they did well against them at the Sanchez-Pizjuan, but...
They tried to mirror Leicester, essentially. They played the same system as Leicester, which was 4-4-1-1, and both teams didn't seem to be interested at all in starting moves by playing out from the back. It was just hoof the ball forward, and what was really important in that game was kind of winning second balls. And when you're playing Samir Nasri as one of your sort of front two, if you like, it's not going to work. He's not going to win those second balls, particularly against people like Wes Morgan and Hoof.
Right. Well, this is what Leicester, Hoof and Morgan had spent all of last season swatting away, those kind of crosses in. So I was surprised that that's all that Sevilla seemed to try. Did they ever get away a proper shot in that second half?
Yeah, they had... they hit the bar from long range.
They hit the bar,
range,
that was in the first half, I think.
No, it was the second half.
Was that
and
the second
then
half? Sorry.
Ben Yedder put... I'm not sure if he was offside or not, but he blazed the rebound over when it looked like he was going to volley it in.
Right.
And then just before Nasri got sent off, was just when it was starting to look uncomfortable, was just when Correa had the shot saved by Schmeichel.
Before, they did have shots.
It was a minute before, and then Nasri stuck his face into... Jamie Vardy's, which is totally understandable. I think we all want to do that.
Right, Jamie Vardy. Well, let's move on to that. Obviously, we're going to have to come back and salute Kasper Schmeichel for his extraordinary performance across the two legs. But you mentioned the Vardy-Nasri coming together. If it was intentional, it was quite brilliant because that was exactly the moment when momentum was building for Sevilla. And that whole thing not only took Sevilla down to 10 men, but it completely killed what they were putting together.
Well, it was so nasty and spiteful from Jamie Vardy, but... brilliantly executed, and I'm sure there would have been much more uproar if it had been a foreign player doing that, but instead he's England's number nine. But what he did, obviously, he completely wound him up.
Yeah.
He fouled him, then he pushed him, then he pushed him again, at which point Nasri could take no more. Remember, this is Nasri who's on a booking already, and then kind of puts his face in there. And
Vardy's leading forward. Was it calculated by Vardy, do you think?
I think so.
Simon?
His exaggerated reaction to that coming together of foreheads.
No, but do you think he was trying to get... Was it all planned to get Nasri sent off?
Well, it's either that... I mean, either way, it doesn't look good on Vardy. He either deliberately wound Nasri up so he would get sent off, or he was just having a night of behaving like
I think it was genius. It was streetwise from street football.
You know? Yeah. You were talking about moral high ground and that, which is not something we ever like to occupy in this pod. However, there have been a lot of people asking, is there going to be the same tone adopted with Vardy as there was over, say, Suarez and his diving in the Barcelona game against PSG?
From us or from
basically they were comparing. There's some people have had screen grabs of the article about Vardy and his streetwise behaviour and similar articles about complaining about Suarez's diving. For me, there is absolutely a parallel between them. If you got upset with Suarez, you can't really celebrate Vardy. But I think here we just saluted.
I don't think you're celebrating it as much as saying, it's pretty clever. Because remember, with Suarez, he is exaggerating absolutely no contact in an honest attempt from a defender to win the ball and trying to win a penalty. Whereas Vardy, actually, you could say that Nasri was a monumental fool for getting involved with him at that time of the game. He tried to provoke him, whereas Suarez was just trying to outright cheat.
I'm not sure.
I don't think it looks good on Vardy, but it doesn't look good on Nasri either, whereas a PSG defender trying to win the ball hasn't made a fool of himself, whereas Nasri has.
Anyway, Nasri and Sevilla are out, and Leicester goes through, and another brilliant performance from Craig Shakespeare's team.
And Gigi Buffon does not want to face this Leicester side.
Well, indeed. We'll talk about the draw, which will happen on Friday morning in a second or two. Is there a chance this is actually going to have a negative impact on Leicester's survival chances? They're three off the bottom three. They're away at West Ham this weekend. Their continued involvement in the Champions League and the mounting pressure in that competition, the risk is it might distract them in terms of team selection, in terms of the way they're focused.
I think this is exactly what they need. They've needed this spell of games to get their confidence back and to rediscover themselves. And I think one of the problems that Claudio Ranieri had was that he didn't trust the players to cope with the workload that they were going to have this season, that they were going to be playing on three fronts. And so he was tinkering a lot more. He was changing the formation around, changing the lineup around. And instead, what Craig Shakespeare's done in every game so far, he's played the same 11, aside from Ndidi. And, yeah, we've seen them get back to their very best. And, yeah, this team does seem to have the energy levels to be able to cope with this. And I think this gives their season a purpose again. Yes, obviously staying up in the Premier League is part of that, but it just gives them something to get excited about and change the mood and the atmosphere around the team going right into this final stretch of the season.
Right. The playing as they were last season, they do the simple things extremely well, and that can be extremely underrated, but it's working. And Vardy's back as well, beyond all the nastiness with Nasri. He also won the free kick for the opening goal. He's scoring as well. He scored in his last few games. The last home game, he completely tore Ranocchia apart, who one of the slowest defenders I've ever seen. But he was out of sorts badly under Ranieri, and Shakespeare's got him playing again, which is, as we saw last season, crucial to Leicester.
How concerned are you about West Ham's chances against Leicester this weekend?
I would put Leicester as favourites to win, given West Ham's recent form and Leicester's recent form.
Right, OK. Well, the draw coming up on Friday. Peter Blow, by the way, saying, good to see Kante at the Leicester game. Not surprised to also see him at the Juventus game that same night. Clever on that. Yes, Leicester then the only Premier League team through to the final eight of the Champions League. They're just four matches away from that Cardiff final. The other teams through to the quarterfinals: Monaco, holders Real Madrid, last year's runners-up, Atletico Madrid, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund and Juventus, of whom, Gigi Buffon, as you mentioned, said, who do I prefer not to play? Leicester. They are a dangerous and passionate team who can cause trouble for opponents who take the initiative. We would have everything to lose. This is the kind of traditional point where we introduce the what's gone wrong with the Premier League in Europe topic. Interesting stats regarding this. In six seasons, the Premier League has only had five Champions League quarter-finalists. To put that in perspective, Spain have had, Simon, 17. And if you're not shocked enough yet, bear in mind that even France have had seven, if you include Monaco.
Well, did you hear Richard Dunn's explanation for this on BT? He said that Leicester essentially doing well because they're the only English team that plays the English style in the Champions League.
Right.
The others all play this continental style, which seems to do the continental teams in the continental competition well, but not English teams. You know?
That's an interesting point. Arsene Wenger has a theory, but he's not going to tell us it. At his press conference yesterday, he was saying on the Premier League's Champions League problems, he said there are some obvious reasons, he said, but I don't think people are really interested, .. What do you think he might be hinting at or referring to?
He might be suggesting that we're more interested in pure entertainment in our domestic competition, and that is our ultimate goal. And if our teams built for entertainment don't measure up against teams built for footballing quality, then, you know, we'll take the entertainment. Thank you very much. See you next season.
I would say this has been the most entertaining round of 16 of Champions League games that we've probably ever seen. There have been 62 goals. There have been a number of games which stood out, both legs in the PSG-Barcelona one, for different reasons. We saw comebacks this week. Yeah, Leicester coming back from an aggregate deficit, Monaco coming back from an aggregate deficit. Yeah, in many respects, it's kind of matched the Premier League in these entertainment stakes. I think what he might be referring to as well is that because the Premier League is so wealthy, I think clubs are now, it's less and less imperative for them to get into the top four, get into the Champions League, aside from a prestige stake, because they can survive without the Champions League.
Well, as James says about whether top teams are wondering whether it's worth getting into the Champions League or how important it is for them, you see at the moment Sky reasoning that the Champions League rights weren't as important to them as the Premier League rights, for which they paid a fortune, and that their viewing figures were down, and perhaps people are losing a little bit of interest in that, which might have something to do as well with the clubs who are in the Champions League not being your Manchester United's or Liverpool's.
Right. I mean, yeah, certainly the domestic league's always going to have a bigger audience. And if you have to have one league, you can only afford one. That's the one you'd go for. But the viewing figures, I mean, it's, you can't look at those without bearing in mind the fact that it has moved to a platform with a far less of a diffusion, let's say, among the viewing public. And, of course, vastly inferior staff working on it. Right. Hang on. At this point, we must interrupt this discussion to discuss Wednesday night's delights at the Stade Louis II. Is that Laurence Julien on the phone?
It is indeed, Jimbo.
Hey, how are you, Julien?
Very good, and you?
I am well. Listen, last time we spoke, you were still reeling and a little bit down, it's fair to say, from what Paris Saint-Germain got up to at Barcelona. Did Monaco put the smile back on your Ligue 1 loving face?
It did, indeed, my friend. It did, although I'm not a Monaco fan. I'm a PSG fan, so it, you know, still hurting very much because I do feel that PSG should be in that draw on Friday. But at least seeing Monaco go through and the way they did it as well, I think over the two legs, they were the better side. I put a big, big smile back on my face.
Right. So many people marvelling, particularly at that first 45 minutes from Monaco on Wednesday night. And a lot of people, for example, Matt Bristow, saying how many of this tremendously exciting team will be left come the end of next summer? How much can they hold on to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's such a shame that you know already that this team will be taken apart, kind of, you know, in the summer by bigger clubs. That's the way it is, though. Monaco have become a feeder club and Ligue 1 feeder league. We all know that. It's just a shame sometimes, especially when things are working so well, that you can't see them a bit more together. But I think Kylian Mbappe, who's obviously the talk at the moment, will stay for at least another year, that's for sure. But I think if you look at Bernardo Silva, who almost left last summer, I think this is, you know, it's the end. This is the last season for him at Monaco. One of the two fullbacks, whether that's Sidibe or Mendy, I think will go as well. And of the two defensive midfielders, Bakayoko and Fabinho, one of them will go, if not both of them as well. Fabinho was very close, again, to leaving last summer. He was outstanding last night. I think he was by far, for me, the best Monaco player on the pitch, the best player on the pitch, full stop. So I think, you know, you can expect three would be, you know, the best in many ways for Monaco, but they could easily lose four or five. Think about Thomas Lemar as well, who could go. So Falcao probably as well. So I think if they get only three leaving, they would have had a good summer.
Just to follow up on that, one of the players you mentioned wasn't in action last night, which is Radamel Falcao, which was thought to be a bit of a real blow to Monaco's chances, and they work without their best defender, Glick, either, and yet they still did it.
Yeah, and if you look at the team that started last night, the average age is 24 years and 2 months. And if you take out Raji, who's 32, and Subasic, who's 32 as well, the remaining nine other players average 22 years and 1 month. It's just incredible. At that age, considering the pressure they were under in the second half when City played better and scored that goal by Sané, to still, you know, have the, I don't know how you call it, the gut or, you know, whatever, the talent for sure, but, you know, to have that extra thing, to still score that third goal and go through at that age with you know, hardly no experience at all, is just incredible, I think.
It was a remarkable performance, the way that they seemed to have gone back into their shells, retreated into the game, and then were able to find a goal so quickly when they actually needed it. Monaco returned to Liga with the Russian millions of Ribolovlev. What's the situation now behind them? Is there no way that they can draw on the funds if they do have a proper Champions League run to maybe keep some more of the side together?
Yeah, I think he might try. But he knows that if you get a 50 million euros offer for Bernardo Silva, who you bought for 15, which was, you know, a big investment at the time because he was only playing for the Benfica reserve, you can't say no to 50 million for Bernardo Silva or for Lemar or for Bakayoko. That's the problem. And as much, you know, the Ribolovlev is worth, I think, something around £7 billion. So for him, you know, it's, and they're all good with financial fair play now. So he could spend more and he could, you know, increase wages and he could buy another player or two for 20 or 25 million euros. That's not a problem. The problem is you can't say no to that kind of money either. Like they couldn't say no to Martial and, you know, and although they would have liked to keep him for a bit longer. So that's more the issue. But it'd be interesting to see come the summer, especially, you're right, Jimmy, if they go to the semi-final or, you know, who knows, even maybe to the final, if they win the league, and they might still do the domestic treble as well, which would be incredible. And if then they still sell one or two or three maybe, see how they replace them, because they've got other talented youngsters in the academy and on the bench. But maybe they might want to go for more experience and better players, a bit like Glick, for example, who was a very crucial addition in the summer. best spend a bit more money to keep the team at that kind of level, because there's no doubt that that PSG will come stronger, that maybe Lyon will come stronger as well, that Marseille will come stronger next season. And if Monaco did the treble, you would hope that they would want to keep the same level to try to retain it again for the following season.
Absolutely. Well, in the meantime, we should enjoy this vintage of Monaco while we can. 123 goals they've scored this season. They'll be aiming to put a few more in the net this weekend against Caen. What are they, 5 points clear on top of Ligue 1?
3 points clear of PSG, and it's 126, Jimbo, by now, if you add the three from last night.
Of course.
Will they keep the manager?
Yeah, that's the other question as well. I think, there's no doubt that we can call him a little magician now, because I think he's worked wonder. If you think about the two quarterfinals in the last 3 years, the one in 2015 and the one this season, he's really worked wonder with why hard, whether that was a defensive team in 2015, and a very amazing going forward, but still very young team this year. And Jim, you're right. I think if I was a big club looking for a manager, it would be top of my list.
Create a beautiful website or online store with an award-winning template from Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code FOOTBALLWEEKLY to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace, make your next move, make your next website.
Julien Laurent. Well, Man City, I mean, this isn't anything that hasn't already happened to Arsenal, of course, and Spurs earlier this season. But for all Monaco's brilliance, and they were brilliant in that first 45 minutes, what about City? What about their apparent lack of hunger or focus? Guardiola talking about them not turning up.
In the first half in particular, Monaco's team just seemed more, well, taller for a start. Like bigger, more athletic, a different species of super footballer. And Manchester City, I don't know. And Raheem Sterling was like a tree fern in a forest of redwoods.
Right.
And
we all thought that.
I would have thought so. Mm. They were bullied to an extent in that first half. Second half did change. Things did change. What was impressive about Monaco in the second half wasn't so much that they regained composure having conceded and scored quickly afterwards. It's that a team that was so young managed to kill the game after that point. And Manchester City accomplished nothing in the remaining 13 minutes or so.
Right.
I did think the referee was terrible. The referee really irritated me.
Really?
He had, like, any... I don't think that Monaco were particularly, like, were more guilty than Manchester City. I'm not criticising either team. Any contact, you could throw yourself to the ground, you were guaranteed a free kick. He blew his whistle for the end of the first half after, like, a couple of seconds before 45 minutes were up, even though a couple of goals had been scored. In the second half, he signalled to his fourth official that he was going to give 3 minutes of stoppage time. And then Monaco used the entire 90th minute making a substitution. And he still blew his whistle before the end of those 3 minutes. I mean, I heard a lot too much of that man's whistle.
Right. OK. Fair enough. Back to City's performance. No shots on target in the first half.
I think that happened against Stoke as well a week ago.
For City?
Yeah.
Right.
So it's not an isolated incident, and it's something that when you look at how that team was set up, so attacking, for it not to even be able to muster a single shot is a concern. But I think that was also part of the structural problems that City had. And also, I think while there's been some signs of progress in the Champions League this year, and by progress I mean outstanding, genuinely memorable performances like against Barcelona in the first leg against Monaco, this game felt very familiar to how they played in the second leg against Real Madrid in the semi-finals last year, where they just didn't turn up. And it wasn't... that wasn't a contest for 90 minutes at all. They just... it was very meek. In this, it was very similar in the first half, I thought. Pep tried to change things. He switched the system to 4-4-2 in the second half, brought De Bruyne a little bit deeper to help them build from the back.
And Silva looked a lot better.
Silva looked better when he was pushed forward. But again, this City side seemed to be mentally fragile, I think. And when you look at what Guardiola seemed to be doing at the start of the season with getting rid of sort of leaders of that team, or certainly in terms of Joe Hart, or leaving some of those leaders like Yaya Toure out and Aguero out at different stages of the season, as though they were kind of responsible for allowing that to happen within the team dynamic, you kind of still see it being a problem at City.
Hmm. For 3 years, they've drifted in and out of performances. They haven't had a serious title challenge, which is disgraceful for a squad of that talent. And the Champions League last season, they kind of went out with a bit of a whimper against Real Madrid in the second leg. And this time again, the last 16, and every time you think that they've kind of got it under Guardiola, where they went through a little run of destroying teams around February and early March, and then just they drift back into goalless draws with Stoke. You question that squad's mentality. And
right.
Also, how much, I think this also leads back to perhaps one of the problems that English football has, because now that they're out and not going to win the Premier League, you would have thought that there will be a desire from certain sections to pounce on Guardiola and go, "You're not so smart now, you know, can't take it on with Kolarov at centre back, can you?" But you have to give these managers time, and whether we are capable of doing that, I think will say a lot about where English football is and whether it's capable of actually challenging in Europe. If you accept that you have three huge teams in Europe which are always going to be there, perhaps these English teams need to actually build and let a manager like Guardiola build.
I think performances like last night do welcome kind of criticism of his philosophy and how stubborn he is, because they had a two-goal lead from the first leg. Why not just kind of a more measured style of football?
Right.
But I think you look at the defenders he's got, and you can kind of understand why he wants to play on the front foot, because he doesn't trust them. And for him, in his press conference before the game, it was all about scoring goals. And I think that is because...
And it's fair to say that Sergio Aguero had a couple of really good chances.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Sane came into things in the second half as well. But, you know, as we saw in a lot of those players in the forward positions for City, just again don't seem to get the kind of defensive responsibility that I think Guardiola expects from
right.
Well, you saw that particularly with the first two goals. Yeah. Sane, I mean, what's he doing? Just lets Mendy just drift past him, and all of a sudden Stones is sliding on his backside.
Just another category in which, say, Bernardo Silva outclasses David Silva. For some. Yeah.
Well, with 13 minutes, they were 30 minutes left, they're going through, and for all of Monaco's attacking brilliance, it's one set piece that means they're going out, a free header.
Yeah.
Where was the leader?
One or two tweets here. Misha Frankel Duval asks, "Will Mbappe age better than Mbop?" That's probably one of the better Hansen.
Mbop has aged terrifically well.
Do you think so?
I think he should aspire to aging as well as Mbop.
All right, there
it's
you go.
It's 25 years since Mbop came out.
No.
Yeah, and they're having an anniversary tour right now, Jimbo, if you want to go. Yeah.
Hansen?
Yeah.
On their own, or they got...
the Mbop tour. Yeah.
Brilliant. Tom Victor says, "Didn't see Monaco playing like this under Ranieri, the snakes." Yeah, that's a fair point, actually. Ian Burbridge, though, points out 50% of this year's Champions League quarterfinalists have done what?
Won their title.
Average three goals a game?
No. Parted company with Claudio Ranieri.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. It's a remarkable statistic. Also in the Champions League this week, nothing much to say about Juve's 1-0 win over Porto, 3-0 on aggregate, unless there is something you want to say.
Only one brief
thing. One brief thing.
And that's the only team in the round of 16 not to concede a goal. Defence wins championships.
Right, okay.
And the last thing, they're the only team unbeaten in the competition.
Yet to lose a game. Not conceding a goal, meanwhile, was exactly what Jan Oblak was up to for Atletico Madrid against Bayer Leverkusen. I imagine, did we all see that extraordinary triple save? Just remarkable.
I think as Atleti often got forgotten as a contender for this competition, Oblak often gets forgotten in that who is the best goalkeeper in the world sort of debate as well.
Right. Good shout. Okay, well, the draw coming up anyway on Friday, I think 11 a.m, swiftly followed by the draw for the Europa League, with the second legs of which happening this evening. But coming up on Sunday, the late game on Sunday, Man City back in action. They're at home to Liverpool. Simon, is the misery going to continue, given how good Liverpool tend to be in games against Man City?
I mean, hard to call, but possibly. Liverpool, I mean, we say it every time, they come up against one of the top six sides. They have an excellent record against them. Last season, they won brilliantly at Manchester City. And, I mean, the potential's there. That's the confusing and must be very dispiriting thing about Liverpool for their supporters is that you go into games away at Manchester City full of optimism, but there are many games where you can't be so optimistic. And it is slightly strange that it is the toughest games where they have the best chance.
Right. A City team that, as you mentioned, James, had no shots in the first half against Stoke. They had one in the whole game, 0-0. It finished. What do you think, Jacob?
I quite fancy Liverpool for this on the break, with their pace on the break, and the fact you would expect City to dominate possession, and Liverpool tend to be better against teams like that who don't give them the ball and then leave themselves vulnerable. But at the same time, sort of think back to that game when City were kind of written off before Spurs, and then came out and pulverised them for 70 minutes before chucking it away at the end. But still, I think their highest level is higher than Liverpool's.
Right, okay. But whether they'll be at it after this massive blow to their morale that Wednesday represented. Also in the Premier League this weekend, you got Stoke, who are hosting Chelsea this time around. A Chelsea team who were in action on Monday night. They beat Man United in a measured performance. Quite a vicious and violent, thuggish performance. Fair to say?
From Manchester United.
Well, yeah.
Cynical.
Right, cynical. Yeah. And Chelsea goes through to a Wembley date with Spurs, where Spurs love to play, of course. A lot of people saying they look on for the double, but they've got Stoke next. Oh, of course, Mark Hughes, former Chelsea player. Is this a game that excites anyone, Stoke-Chelsea? Not so much.
I think Chelsea are just so reliable. You can see them getting the result that they right. need in this game. But Stoke, as we saw, frustrated City. And they played two men up front in that game. A high energy game to frustrate City, and it could serve them well in this one as well.
All right. Also this weekend, on Saturday, the early game is at the Hawthorns. Arsenal are in town. They lost 2-1 there last season. West Brom, though, seem to have finished their season extra early. Since reaching 40 points, they've lost the last two, conceding 5 goals, scoring none. That's not what we think of as Tony Pulis football, Simon.
Well, there is that. And there's also talk of records against the top six.
Yeah.
West Brom's record against the top third of the division this season is terrible. It's a 1-draw, 8 defeats, 3 goals scored and 20 conceded. And they still have Manchester United, Manchester City, Chelsea and Liverpool to come. So they've had a great season. They're 8th. That's fabulous. They've got 40 points on the board. The rest of the season might be a little uncomfortable.
Right, okay.
Apparently, once teams coached by Tony Pulis get to 40 points, their win percentage then, on average, is just 13.9%.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Of course, Arsenal's win percentage over the last 8 games isn't much better than that.
No.
Possibly worse. Well, actually, it might be better. 3 wins out of 8, but 2 of those were against non-league opposition, the other at home to Hull. Huh. Okay, well, Arsenal need the points. Of course, they are 5 points off the top 4, assuming they do want to get into the Champions League, but they have those 2 games in hand. Meanwhile, Spurs are going to be hosting good old Southampton. 4-1, Tottenham beat Southampton at St Mary's, but of course, that was with Kane. Mm. Kane! What's the latest on his ankle?
It looks like he's going to be out for, 6-7 weeks?
That is the early indication, but they still haven't decided.
Okay, apparently there's doubts over Dembele as well. Saints coming into this game off back-to-back victories in the Premier League. And they've had a bit of a rest as well. This is only their 3rd game in a month.
Back-to-back wins away from home as well, in which scored 4 goals in both of those games.
With Redmond and Gabbiadini looking excellent.
Yeah, and also, I know a lot's been made of the fact that Spurs unbeaten at home so far this season. In the league, and I think they've only conceded, 7 goals at White Hart Lane? But the last team to beat Spurs at White Hart Lane was Southampton in the penultimate game of last season.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
You would have thought that Son Heung-min will be playing up front, and Tottenham struggled so much without Harry Kane earlier in the season, barely scored a goal from open play. Just shows they need to probably strengthen in that department again in the summer, given Vincent Janssen's indifference.
Are you calling this for Saints, Jacob, James?
Draw.
I still think Spurs have enough about them to win this. I think, in contrast to when Kane was out the last time, they've evolved a little bit. We've seen them go to that 3-4-2-1 formation, which serves them well, and has Dele Alli pushed up further forward as well. So I think most of his goals this season have come in that formation.
Right. Is that how they played against Millwall, when certainly they did score 6 goals for Adam?
Well, I think he's essentially now become a second striker.
Right.
And so I think the burden will not be as heavy on Son and Janssen as it was perhaps in that period.
Right.
Perhaps.
Okay. Let's turn our attention to events down the bottom end of things, Simon. Who are Watford playing this weekend?
Crystal Palace.
Are you playing Crystal Palace? Away from home. You're still 7 points off the drop, Watford.
Yes. In different form.
Mm.
But with that precious cushion, I don't know. Crystal Palace will be a tough game.
Right. I think a lot of us find the Hornets quite inscrutable this year.
Yeah. It's kind of been hard for the neutral to connect with them emotionally.
Mm.
Players have changed quite regularly, mainly because of injury. The form has been wildly inconsistent. There have been great victories against, you know, Manchester United and Arsenal, but at the same time, a lot of pretty humdrum performances.
Right.
It's very hard to know what to expect.
Yeah. You're at Selhurst Park.
Yeah.
Crystal Palace have had back-to-back wins and back-to-back clean sheets, but they have notoriously poor form at home. Crystal Palace, who are only a point above Hull, and thus the bottom three in the relegation battle elsewhere, Hull themselves, will be at Everton. And the man who earned them 3 points last weekend, Omar Niasse, won't be able to play because he's on loan from Everton. Yikes. Everton themselves, in terms of goal scorers, have one or two issues, not least the fact that Lukaku has chosen this week to come out and say he's not signing a new deal with the Toffees. Is that a big deal, or is it just one of those things that people say in the process of negotiations, and then in the end maybe he stays, maybe he doesn't?
I think he won't be signing a new contract. He probably is well aware of several clubs interested in him, probably notably Chelsea, who are linked with Lukaku and Ross Barkley this morning.
I mean, Fintan Fay made the point that this was literally the first thing he said in his first presser when he arrived at Everton, that he was delighted to be there. Plenty of big names had come to the club and then moved on after a couple of seasons, and that's what he wanted to do.
I don't think Everton fans would be kidding themselves about Lukaku viewing them as a stepping stone, and they don't have the financial strength to hold on to a player like that if he plays as he can. It's just, I don't think they need to hear it so openly from him.
Right.
And I think he gave the impression in that interview that he expected Everton to be something that they're clearly not. He said, oh, I've been speaking to Vincent Kompany, and Kompany said, you know, first year at City or whatever, you know, I was wondering, what am I doing here? And then all of a sudden they bought Rubinho, they threw all this money at the team, and we started winning silverware. It's clear, even with the new owner at Everton, that's probably not going to happen. But, I mean, it is surprising in that barely a month ago, his agent, Mina Reiler, said he's 99.9999% going to sign a new contract. And then it's not shocking that he's leaving because his agent is Mina Reiler.
Right.
So, you
know. Everton fans just have to hope that Ronald Koeman's not planning a similar departure. He still has another 2 seasons after this one on his contract, does Lukaku. But if you're Everton, maybe this is the time to make some, you know, extra cheese off his departure.
Though, Everton fans that I've spoken to aren't totally overwhelmed by Lukaku. I mean, he contributes lots of goals, but he also has, you know, extended
goals.
Periods in many games where he doesn't. And, you know, he takes chances, like he takes shots from positions where he shouldn't. You know, there's frustration with him too.
Okay.
I don't think he's the... I mean, his goal-scoring record, given his youth, is incredible. But I think it's possible to live without him.
Everton looking for their 6th consecutive home win. Just below Hull, anyway, are this Middlesbrough team, who are presumably what going to get a new manager bounce now, or a no Aitor Karanka bounce in their clash at home to United, who I think I'm right in saying they haven't beaten since 2008
in
the league.
I would have thought the decision has been made with the games after Manchester United to come. This is
right.
A bit of a free hit.
But yeah, I mean, often the teams...
United obviously have played at Chelsea on Monday, had a unhappy journey back from that. Their plane didn't arrive and they had to get a coach back and got home in the middle of like 4 o'clock in the morning, and then they're playing tonight. So certainly Middlesbrough have had better preparation for this game.
Right.
But
including firing Karanka, some would suggest.
Yeah.
Borough do have to be very concerned because they dropped in last weekend to the bottom three. I don't sure if you've seen their running in their last six. I mean, their last six games look horrible. Pretty much all Borough games look horrible, many people suggest, but they have to face Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City, and I think Liverpool in there. Big sides.
Their only wins this year have come in the FA Cup.
That's true.
Haven't scored in 5.
Yeah. They've only scored 9 goals since the turn of the year, and only 2 of those in the Premier League. Anyway, still, United with a terrific record against them, whether they're tired from the Rostov game or not. Anyway, bottom of the pile, 6 points off safety, but with a game in hand are Sunderland, who will be hosting Burnley. Could this be the game where Burnley finally get an away win, Jacob?
They've been close in recent weeks. Mm. They had the 1-1 draw at Hull. They took the lead at, they were 2-1 up against Swansea, and then they lost in the last minute, and they were a goal up against Liverpool on Sunday, just gone. This could easily be, if it's not going to happen here, you have to think it's not going to happen. But I think it's obviously a much bigger game for Sunderland, given their plight. If everything goes against them this weekend, they could be 9 points off safety with 10 games left to play, which would seem like too big an ask for them, even despite their recent escape pacts. If they don't win this, then I think they can start planning for the Championship next season.
Three defeats in a row. They haven't scored any goals in that time. What's happened? Has it been injuries or something?
Sunderland very good. They had that win at Palace where they were 4-0 up at half time, but that is now looking more like a freak than it did at the time. Mm. When it looked extraordinary, now it just seems like it was a one-off.
Right, okay. Also this weekend, of course, you've got your West Ham-Leicester game, which you think Leicester look very much the favourites in. West Ham, here's a stat, have the worst shooting accuracy in the league, even worse than Middlesbrough's. I know. There is another game this weekend in the Premier League. It involves Bournemouth, and they're taking on Swansea, who are level with Leicester there. They're only 3 points from safety. It's going to be a big game this for a Bournemouth team that looked revitalised last weekend against the Hammers. Jacob?
I just thought it was interesting that Jack Wilshere has been on the bench for Bournemouth in the last couple of games, and Eddie Howe suddenly seems slightly cool on the idea of signing him permanently, which he was very hot on earlier in the season. And now Bournemouth have gone to 4-4-2. He needed to get another striker up alongside Josh King, which is now Benik Afobe. And that means that there's no place at the moment for Wilshere in a two-man midfield.
Right.
He's got, at the moment, he's behind Sermon, Gosling and Harry Arter.
Okay.
In that sense.
Josh King, who's smoking form at the moment. Seven goals in his last five games.
Yeah, huge for them, given that just after the transfer window, having already lost Nathan Aki, who was so important for them at the back when Chelsea recalled him, and then just straight after the transfer window, Callum Wilson did his knee for the second time, and which looked like Bournemouth wouldn't be able to score any goals. Instead, Josh King's come up.
All right. Well, Llorente, who picked up a dead leg against Hull, still a doubt for that game, which should have a big impact on Swansea. That's your Premier League weekend. One or two other things just to mention. We'll do that after this.
Hello everyone, this is producer Ben, again. I've been telling you over the last few weeks about Cornerstone's pre-shave scrub and sensitive skin gel, and now I'm going to tell you about their post-shave balm. It's got soothing and cooling mint and honey extracts to restore your skin's natural moisture balance and reduce irritation. It's the perfect way to finish off your shave. Don't believe me? Try it for yourself by heading to cornerstone.co.uk/guardian50, where you'll get 50% off your first box.
Matt Smith asks, was I seeing things on EFS last Sunday, or was Mark Hamill in the crowd at Genoa Sampdoria? I think he means Massimo Ferrero, does he?
I imagine so, yeah.
Who's Massimo Ferrero?
He's the Sampdoria owner.
Right.
And general nutcase.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's who you mean. Coming up this weekend, PSG are taking on Lyon, who are another of these very, very exciting new Ligue 1 sides that are suddenly populating the European fixtures. They're in action against Roma this Thursday evening. They're 4-2 up from the first leg. Memphis Depay, we mentioned on Monday, scored a brilliant goal in their 4-0 win last weekend. Always worth a look, Leon. Sampdoria, meanwhile, of said Massimo Ferrero, will be hosting Juventus. Meanwhile, a game that took place this week, Simon, that you went to, an especially heated, tasty-looking Ligue 1 encounter between AFC Wimbledon and the other team.
Yes, the other team that were...
League One, sorry.
Yeah, not Ligue 1, unless you're visiting from our near neighbours. But yes, MK, as they are referred to.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the key issues that Wimbledon have with them is their appropriation of their nickname. So not prepared to concede Dons today.
So much so that the scoreboard at King's Meadow didn't have the word Dons on it.
It did not, no.
And nor, I believe, did the programme have any reference on the cover to their name.
No, the programme didn't say on the cover who was playing at all. And the manager's notes were notably, like, that there was no, we welcome today the players and from MK Dons. There was none of that.
Right.
Yes, niceties, there weren't that many.
Right.
And, as an occasion, I thought it was really excellent. You know, the atmosphere was hot, but there was a lot of vitriol from the home fans.
Right.
But it was in the right spirit, if intense anger can be called right.
MK, whatever you want to call them, now assume the role of kind of pantomime villains for AFC, especially now that AFC are actually doing better than them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long it'll last. Neil Ardley afterwards said that he doesn't see it ending anytime soon. And certainly while, Pete Winkleman,
why would it ever end? I mean, surely football is built on this kind of, there's so many illogical hatreds, take Crystal Palace and Brighton, that there's actually a basis for an enmity between these two.
Yeah, when I say end, what I mean is calm down slightly.
Right.
Pete Winkleman, who's the music impresario who was behind the old move to MK Dons, was there. His safety couldn't be guaranteed in the director's box, but he was in with the away fans. The existence of hate figures such as him will prolong it. I do wonder whether the MK Dons players get it very much. You know, that none of them will have been there when the club kind of was started. And it must be slightly bemusing to them to have this level of fury when they come to a club that they don't feel any natural relationship with. I don't think the same is true of Wimbledon's players. They certainly, there was a lap of honour after the game, and there was it was a very intense game for them as much as it was
right. Their biggest game of the season, would it be?
Certainly. I mean, it was the one that, from the moment the fixture list was out, right, that was circled in red pen. Neil Ardley said afterwards that he was worried that the club might not escape from this match with their reputation intact, that things might go really horrible outside the stadium or inside, that there might be violence on the pitch. He tried to prepare his team in a very relaxed way. He said that when they played in Milton Keynes earlier in the season, he perhaps put a little bit too much pressure on his team based on this animosity, and they performed very badly in a 1-0 defeat, and he tried to take that all off them this time and prepare them in a relaxed way. And certainly on the pitch, it was a pretty humdrum League One affair. There was not, there were few bookings, there were no flare-ups really. The first half was pretty instantly forgettable.
It wasn't like, say, Gama against Brasileirense. Did you see the amazing clip of this derby game in Brazil where, it really does kick off in the most absolute of senses. There's a tug of war, there's people getting kicked, there's just everything happens.
Like the QPR training game with China, was it a Chinese
with the Chinese team? Yeah, but worse than that.
Really?
Multiply that by many, many numbers. Sorry, Simon.
Yeah, well, so the conduct of the players, if not their ability, was really excellent. MK Dons didn't really start attacking in a convincing way until they were a couple of goals down. Wimbledon deserved to win, probably. And it is astonishing that having had their club kind of destroyed and stolen in 2003, not that long ago, that they stand above MK Dons in the league now. I mean, it really is an incredible journey. It's a footballing miracle to stand aside, pretty much any other. While they clearly still feel that there is an open wound there from the way their club was created, I wonder if they'd swap this journey that they've been on. I mean, it has been incredible. And here they are in the third tier, beating the team that, the club that was stolen from their ashes.
So if they could go back to 2002 and not have the split and just remain what they were, would they take that?
In 2002 they would take it.
Yeah.
Retrospectively now, I'm sure they would take
they
it.
Would
they
take,
would not
yeah.
want their club to have been
I thought you were suggesting
them.
That they wouldn't.
They have had an incredible time these last 13 years.
Right.
Incredible. The you know, the memories they must have of these, you know, consecutive promotions and of, you know, fashioning this club. You know, most of the support teams that were created in the 1880s and 1890s.
Yeah.
And to be there at the birth of a club and then such a short amount of time later, you know, where they are now. Anyway, I think it's fabulous and phenomenal. And,
okay. And were you there as a journalist or just as a football line?
I was there as a journalist, though I didn't have a pass or consequently a seat in an overcrowded press box.
Right.
So I was sitting very much with the fans.
Right, okay. Excellent, excellent. Simon, fascinating. Thanks so much for that eyewitness account of a monumental game. That brings us to the end of this Football Weekly Extra. But we will return on Monday. For now, it's thanks to you, Simon Burton, Jacob Steinberg, James Horncastle and producer Ben. Do have yourselves a great weekend with all that fine football that's on the way, and we'll catch up with you after. Cheers.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.